Oh, no.
Hi, New York. City, New York. We're going to get you next year, Sarah. Nobody ever introduces Sarah. I don't get it. It took me 4 years to catch up. The next introduction is an extremely special one for us. We have today, as a keynote speaker, a true leader in the field of special education, Dr. Burton Bled. Many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with his works, his constant and long-lived advocacy for exceptional individuals throughout society. Dr. Black comes to us today from Syracuse University, where he's dean of the School of Education. He has had a long history in the field of special education, starting as a teacher for mentally impaired students. From that point on, he started university work in Connecticut, was the chairman of special education at Boston University, and then went on to New York University and Syracuse. He's a recipient of numerous awards, has been served as expert testimony in landmark decisions regarding handicapped people. In the Parr case, he served on the President's Committee for the Handicapped. He's still a consultant to that agency. He has received almost every single year of his professional career numerous honorariums from citizens groups, from professional groups, senators, Congress, and is the author of some 200 books and monographs. Probably those that are most familiar to you is his Victorial Essay, Christmas in Purgatory, as a student studying in special education and undergraduate. It was the first book that I became aware of Dr. Blass and the many others that have followed. We are pleased to have Dr. Black here today. His schedule, of course, is extremely tight. It only permits him to speak to a very few number of groups each year, about six or seven. We are pleased that he accepted an invitation to come to LASI, share his philosophy, wisdom, and inspirations with us. Dr. Black.
Privilege to be here. Such a warm and generous introduction evokes in me remembrances of other experiences I had, and I'll share with you one enjoyed just a few months ago at the annual AAMD meeting. I was only able to be at the AAMD meeting in Miami, Florida for a day, and I was rushing from one activity to another. And as I was walking through the lobby of that big garish hotel, I saw out of the corner of my eye someone who was eyeing me extremely suspiciously. And I've had such experiences in the past, and I see this fellow sort of look, almost walk around to get a good look. And not wanting to prolong this any more than necessary, I finally walked up to him, and he said, "Hey, is your name Burt Black?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know, about 23 or 24 years ago, I'd taken a course with you at what was then called the New Haven State Teachers College, and now it's called Southern Connecticut State College." And I said the usual thing. Your face is very familiar, but I don't remember your name. As a matter of fact, I remember some of those students of that era more vividly than some of my students of last year, who said something about my age. But anyway, I didn't say, of course, I don't remember the name, but of course I remember you. And then he proceeded to ask, by the way, whatever became of you? Well, I want to say a few things about what's in the news today, what's on my mind, and I want to talk about this educability paradox, which I put into the title of my presentation. And then I want to say something about the future. This came in the mail a few weeks ago, portend of the times that are here, maybe the times to come. Some of you will surely come up to me after the meeting and ask for the address. This is a flyer, now a special t-shirt for special educators. You'll love it, and so will your associates. Color white, trim red, quality good. Which in today's hyperbole means probably quality terrible. Well, anyway, you'll really want this t-shirt. We're advised that featured across the front of the t-shirt in blazing red, symbolic of the red apple, is this comment, quote, special educators do it in the least restrictive environment. Get this from Wensco Enterprises, 1301 Grand Avenue, Parsons, Kansas. Now, this came in the mail a few weeks ago announcing apparently the second annual one-day conference on horticultural therapy, because last year I received the same brochure. This is an organization, the Lambs of Libertyville, Illinois, that sponsors this. That's why I brought this along. Some of you may have even been to the conference. And I know that special education has truly come of age when we have both t-shirts emblazoning mottos to lead us forward, and conferences which instruct us how to teach people to talk to plants so that we'll feel better. Not only ordinary people, but this is a conference devoted to persons working with the handicapped, with special reference for the developmentally disabled. Well, there are lots of things in the news that have been recently catching my attention. A few weeks ago, in the New York Times, there was this front page article on Roger G. Bannister, who some of you may know. In 1954, just 25 years ago, ran the first sub 4-minute mile. Now, what does that have to do with the work we're about today? I think it has almost everything to do, if not with the work we're about today, at least what I'm trying to convey to you. Roger Bannister was a medical student in 1954, and possibly because he didn't have time to read the course pages, and didn't have time to learn from the experts in athletics that it was impossible to run a 4-minute mile, that the way the human form is constructed prevents us from ever achieving that lofty goal. Roger Bannister did not know about the impossibility of this feat, and so he achieved it. And what was so engrossing to me about the Bannister achievement is that days later, after the first sub 4-minute mile, there was a second sub 4-minute mile, And today, you can't avoid the watching of a sub-4-minute mile if you turn on the tube on any ordinary Sunday and watch the Wide World of Sports or the CBS Sports or whoever else has these races and other athletic events. Almost everyone runs the 4-minute mile today. And yet, until 1944 or 1954, nobody ran the sub-4-minute mile. There's something else about the Wide World of Sports that could be instructive to us here today. It isn't only mile races where records are broken. You keep listening to the tube, and you'll watch somebody break the 100-meter swim, and you'll see somebody jump higher than anybody else before, or somebody throw something further, or they'll stop a ball game one day and give somebody a ball and say, this is your 600th home run, or your 3,000th hit, or your 122nd steal. What the hell is going on? Now we turn on the sports program or read the sports pages, records are broken all the time. And when we open up the psychology books and the pedagogy books, we learn that mental retardation is a constitutional condition of the central nervous system that's incurable and irremediable, that retarded people can't become less retarded, that people do not learn beyond certain fixed limits. And although it's true that the official definition of mental retardation has changed since 1959, that is the so-called Heber and subsequent Grossman definitions, now do not require mental retardation to be incurable and irremediable. As a matter of fact, there are very few people working in the schools, and even fewer psychologists working in the schools, who do not indeed believe that intelligence is fixed, that retardation is incurable. Well, why the records broken in sports and not in the classrooms? The people in athletics seem to take records more seriously than the behavioral and social scientists. If you want to know who was the fullback on this particular high school's team 8 years ago and 7 years ago and 10 years ago, whenever else this high school had a team, it's very easy to find out. It's also very easy to find out how many yards that fullback ran. Not only how many yards he made, but how many yards his substitute made, and his substitute. We know everything we want to know about sports. We know how fast people run, how high they jump, how long they can run, how long a time they can run, how far they can throw a ball, how swift they can run, how hard they can throw a ball. We know almost nothing about what we achieve intellectually. And so, I have to sort of warm myself up and cool some of you off by getting right to the heart of the matter. And I'll be leaving it for a while and hope to come back to it. The heart of the matter has to do with educability. And I have to recount for you a trip I made about 4 or 5 months ago. I had to go to Indonesia, which some of you may know, is very far away. As a matter of fact, you cannot go, literally cannot go any further from Syracuse than Indonesia. It's a 30-hour plane ride. Of course, when I got into that plane, I had to carry a very full briefcase. Because as everyone knows, if you don't work continuously in the airplane from the time you get on till the time you get off, the plane is going to crash. So I had a great big pile of work to keep me busy and to protect all of those other 200 some odd people from utter catastrophe. Tremendous responsibility and burden while everyone was sleeping on the plane. I had to stay awake, keep my eyes open. I kept calling for more coffee just to make sure that the plane would land safely eventually in Jakarta, which it did. The purpose of my trip to Indonesia is not important for this discussion, so I won't get into that. But I did have a secondary purpose, which is important. I wanted to be able to see whenever residential facilities that were available to the people, especially the children in the country who were severely and multiply handicapped with retardation. And I learned that in the entire country, 140 million people, the fifth largest country in the world, that there is a single residential center for children who are severely and multiply handicapped. And this is a small church-related home for about 14 or 15 children. So I made arrangements to go to see this home, located about an hour outside of Jakarta, capital city. On the way over, I read from beginning through end the a manuscript copy of the Miracle Worker script, the script for that film. The reason why I read that script had to do with the work a friend of mine does in producing films for the public schools. Films and slide shows, audio-visual materials for the schools. And he was adapting the Miracle Worker for some slideshow to be used by children in the schools. And he had asked me to write the introduction to the teacher's manual. And the reason I accepted was that the story of Ann Sullivan and Helen Keller has always been to me the most enthralling and inspiring story concerning human educability that I have ever heard of or read about. So I read the script. Something was bothering me about what I had read. For years I had been teaching my students that the prepotent lesson to be learned from the Ann Sullivan and Helen Keller life together was the educability lesson. The idea that people can learn, people can change, that intelligence is a function of practice and training and motivation, that you really can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And I said that if you understand that in terms of what happened to Ann Sullivan and Helen Keller, you will never once stray from that idea of educability. That if you understand that while Helen Keller was not retarded, was a brilliant, world-renowned personage, she wasn't retarded, if you understand that before she wasn't retarded, she was severely mentally retarded, if you could understand that, if you could appreciate that a human being could be so brilliant now, but could have once been severely mentally defective, then you understand, really understand, what functional mental retardation was supposed to convey as a concept, but never did. And you understand all of this debate about the changing definition. And you understand what we're arguing about on these educability studies. To me, that was the pre-potent lesson, and to this minute, in my view, that's a very important lesson to learn. But you know, as I was going through that manuscript, something was getting at me and I couldn't identify. So I put it aside and went to the other work. Thank God, I did my work beautifully, so the plane came right in on schedule in Jakarta. And now I'm wending my way to this institution. I come to this place, this is several days later, met at the door by a woman who is the director of the facility, not trained. She's called the nurse, but she's not trained as a nurse. She is responsible for these 14 or 15 youngsters. She has about 6 or 8 young girls who are called nurses' aides, who were 15 or 16 years of age, had not been in any formal nursing program, might have had some sort of short course on taking care of people. And I'm now being shown around the institution, which is a nondescript house that might be seen on any street, house of maybe 6 or 7 bedrooms, maybe a house for a large family. The first child I see is ambulatory, and he's blind, and he obviously has not had any, what you might call, parapathology training, or ambulation training. He's sort of groping his way. I asked the nurse about such training, and she said, well, we don't have that. And I asked the nurse if this child is getting any schooling, because he did speak. I spoke with him. Spoke a little English. And the nurse said, no, we don't have any training, any Braille training. We don't have any teacher who could do that kind of thing. I wasn't sure whether she even knew that there was such a system as Braille training. The next child I saw had obviously uncorrected hydrocephalus. He was blind, and he had seizures, he had all of the other associated conditions with his very large head and the uncorrected hydrocephalus. And I asked the nurse if the shunt procedure had been attempted, and she told me she didn't know what that was. And I'm certain in the university medical school in Jakarta they know about it. But she didn't know, and indeed this child had not received that operation. Then they went from bed to bed, because most of all of the other children were non-ambulatory. And I observed for a few hours, saw the attention that was given, the holding, the talking, the cleaning. Now I'm going to surprise you, because after all, I described a 17th or 18th century institution, at best a 19th century institution. They don't know about Braille, they don't know about parapathology, they don't know about shunts. They're not trained. Nobody's been to college. The total budget in the facility for the 14 or 15 children, all of the services, all of the personnel, all of the food, total, less than $10,000 a year. You're going to be surprised, I think, when you now hear me say that if I had a very severely retarded child, and my child did not have a narrow and specific disability, disease, condition, that is amenable to our magic bullets, our science, and you know there are only few such conditions. We can prevent phenylparagluticolangophrenia and Tay-Sachs with amniocentesis. We can possibly even prevent other conditions by avoiding fetus during the first 3 or 4 months, Down syndrome. We could reverse this phenylparagluticolangophrenia with methods we have now, with control of phenylalanine. We put high magnification in somebody that's otherwise blind. We may be able to do certain things with people who are deaf. Sure. The field of mental retardation, there are very few conditions that are reversible through some sort of early treatment or preventable through either some sort of diet control or abortion. If I had a child who did not have one of these specific diseases, and somebody from Mars came down and, you know, gave you an either or set of conditions, either Jakarta for your child, or Willowbrook, or Belchertown, or maybe even one of the institutions in your state, I would pick Jakarta, even though my child would not receive 20th century science. What I'm saying is that we've got marvelous science. And I don't want us to go back to the 18th or 19th centuries. It's wonderful that we could prevent retardation of the child with PKU. It's marvelous that we could take a child who would be otherwise blind and either magnify his vision so he could see or perform certain kinds of surgery to improve his eyesight. It's marvelous that we could mobilize the incus and the scapies and the aliens. It's marvelous that we have these wonderful prosthetic devices. Amputees can now have hands and legs. That's all marvelous. But it seems as if we're paying an enormous price. It's like the story of the fellow who goes into the hospital because he has a bad toe. A simple and grown toenail. And he goes to the emergency room, will you do something for him? He can sit there day and night before they attend to him. But if it's a heart transplant, boy, will they help him. It seems as if we're in a constant position of trading off, that we can't both have the science of the 20th century and the humanism that our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents understood. There are a lot of people who we treat who aren't helped by that magic bullet. Most of those who we treat who have severe and multiple problems will always have severe and multiple problems. They're not going to be cured. They are always going to need a lot of that help. And for those people, the 17th century seemed to have done better than the 20th century. And it doesn't seem to be a reason for that to be. About 5 years ago, I was in Paris at an international meeting on mental retardation. And I had responsibility to make a presentation concerning